Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Safeguarding your privacy online is becoming increasingly difficult with companies, governments, and even some individuals wanting to follow your every step, sometimes to prevent you from harm, sometimes to prevent you from doing others harm, and sometimes just to make money off you. Especially when working in a public space, remember those? Caution is in order. It is not without reason that privacy and security experts have recommended the use of virtual private networks for many years. Our guest today is one of those experts. Stephen Waterhouse, who goes by Seven, is the CEO and co-founder of Orkid, a company that aims to enhance online privacy for everyone, offering a VPN service as well as cryptocurrency. Seven is an engineer by nature, holding a PhD in this topic from the University of Cambridge and having worked on AI, peer-to-peer networks, and blockchain technology for many years. Once again, we'll have lots to discuss. And my name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So Seven, thank you so much for joining us. Funny enough, in the pageant I just competed in, there was a girl there named Seven. And so I'm coming across all kinds of people named Seven right now. Maybe I need to go buy a lottery ticket for Power Seven or something.
It's definitely a lucky number, right?
Right. I think so. My favorite number is 13. So, all right. So here's a good question. What's the best thing you read today?
The briefing document about your podcast, I think, was like the most fascinating one. And your LinkedIn and Twitter posts.
we're going to have fun with you today.
I mean, I'm just, you know, globally consuming news like a crazy news hound in the space of crypto, macroeconomics, politics all day long. So it's hard for me to pick one out. One of the things I read, which I was talking about just before this started, was that Arizona recently, I believe they passed a law or a proposal to change the way payments work in Apple, which was some work that CTO Jay Freeman, who used to work in the app space, specifically jailbreaking for iPhones, has been spearheading in federally and also in California. So with the TLDR, and what that means is that up until now, Apple has had a pretty strong hold over how payments are handled in the App Store. You have to do everything through Apple, and Apple, there's various good reasons for that, like consumer protection, like who do you go get a refund if you don't get what you think you've got? Do you have to go back to the company, or do you go to Apple? Well, Fortnite, the game, you know, Epic Games.
Fortnite!
Yeah, they challenged us and they said, hey, we want to be able to sell skins and sell this and sell that. Why do we have to do in-app payments? Why can't we use, you know, the Fortnite system, the Fortnite credits? Mm-hmm. Now, this has incredible implications for cryptocurrency, right? So if you want to, if you have an app that's on the App Store, and of course, you know, you want it on the App Store because web apps don't work as well, you have to do all your payments, which naturally work with crypto in the crypto, you know, decentralized world. You have to do all those things through the in-app payments, which is, you know, it's possible. And we actually innovated in that space ourselves last year in our application, which I'll talk about soon, allows in-app payments. But that was one of the most fascinating pieces of really like a change in the future. And when we think about privacy and decentralization, we think often about governments and so on, but Google and Apple are major controllers of what we do, what we read, deplatforming we had earlier this year. This is like a major step forward, we think, in the space of decentralization. So that was about the most fascinating thing.
And it is nice. Fascinating indeed. It might be a very big game changer. If it's one state in the US, then they'll have to adapt the system and many more might follow suit.
So Paul, what's the best thing you've read today?
So I'm diving back into politics. It's an interview in one of the main daily newspapers here in the Netherlands with my party leader. As you may or may not know, we have a general election coming up in just under 2 weeks on March 17th. And the campaign is in full swing. But of course, everything is just on TV, in the newspapers and online, because we're still in lockdown, so an in-person campaign is very difficult. But she gave a really good interview, which makes me realize again why I support her.
Awesome.
So what about you? Did you read anything already today?
I would probably say the best thing I read today was I did a lupus advocacy meeting with our representative. And so I was reading all the advocacy requests that the Lupus Foundation for America has out. So that was pretty fascinating because I didn't realize that there was lupus funding through the Department of Defense because so many military people develop lupus due to the toxins that they're exposed to in the UV light and everything like that, which I had no clue. So that was fascinating. So, all right, let's dive in then. As y'all can tell already by where 7 is going, this is going to be a talk about some technology. Right, Paul? Do you have a question teed up? I know you always have something burning to start with.
Well, maybe let's just start with the basics. I said during the introduction that many people have been advocating virtual private networks for many years. But Seven, maybe you can explain to us why is it actually important that we do use VPNs and how they work?
Yeah, sure. I'll try and keep the sort of, I can dig deep in technology if you want to, but I'll try and just keep this at a sort of basic level. And then if you want to go deeper.
Clearly listen to our podcast to know that he can't take a deep dive in technology with me. Clearly.
I had the privilege of actually teaching university students at Cambridge when I was doing my PhD. So I sort of learned a little bit how to try and explain complex stuff in a simple way, hopefully. So the way the internet works is often very opaque to people. And so if we just kind of take the simplest thing, like we're all sitting at home right now. I think we are, like I see you guys are home. And so we're connected to the internet using an internet service provider, an ISP. It's like in the US, it's like an Xfinity or something. And it's like Vodafone in Europe and so on. Now, when you're sending requests for a website and you're receiving the information back, or when you're sending a message, all these kind of things, we don't really think about what's happening to the data. But what's happening is, the service provider is the first place that gets that data. And depending on the kind of application you're using, they can often see all the information about where you're going, and in some cases, the information that you're sending and receiving. And so we'll talk a little bit later about encryption. By using encryption in your application, you're able to hide that information from people who might be sitting in the middle, so what we call a man-in-the-middle attack, literally like, well, I guess it'd be a person in the middle nowadays, but somebody in the middle who's going to read that data and maybe get your credit card information, maybe your billing address, do all these kind of horrible things to you, or even perhaps intercept that data and take it for themselves, right? So an early innovation in the internet, pioneered by the guys around the Netscape time, was to use encryption with web traffic. And this is called SSL or HTTPS. And it's what you normally see when you see like the little padlock on your browser. That's an SSL connection. Not all connections are SSL. There's a lot of applications now that don't use them. There are other protocols that you're using all day long that you don't realize some of them are not actually really encrypted. But even if they are encrypted, the actual location of where you're going to, you know, like you're going to Google, you're searching for this, you're going somewhere else doing that, that information, the ISP has to know that because they're going to go get that traffic, that piece of information for it and send it back to you. Then if you're using a cell phone, of course, that's the cell phone provider. Even better, when you're at a conference or a public Wi-Fi and your cell phone's not working, you connect to Starbucks or the conference website, the Wi-Fi they provided for free. Often those connections are not encrypted, and also that conference or coffee shop is now able to see where you've gone. That sounds a bit scary, right? Like there's all these people who could potentially be watching you. We know that today, so many of the business models on the internet are based around the collection of data and the monetization of data. Like nothing's really free, right? I mean, like everyone needs to wake up. These companies get paid a lot of money. Facebook's not really free.
If it's free, you are the product.
You're the product, right? So forget about even like the monetization of Facebook data and so on and so forth. ISPs and cell phone providers and other people often, as part of their business model, sell the data about where people are going to traders, to retail places like Amazon and so on. And so that information is literally a product, right? If you also want to just hide where you're going because, you know, like you're doing something you don't want your ISP to find out about or doing something with Wi-Fi, and we can get into the, you know, morality and ethics of like what is a good thing to do, what is a bad thing to do. If you're in a regime, like I'll bring up China right away, but if you're in a regime like China, a large majority of what we think is the internet is not available to China. I mean, a lot of what China can see is not available to us, but they balkanize that region. There are other regions in the world, smaller ones, that do the same thing. And so one person's definition of what is a good thing to go do versus a bad thing to go do changes depending on your location. Probably like most people in the world can agree on what really bad things are we can do, but you know, this is a separate question. So how do you control freedom of speech and access? So what a VPN does is you have a company, a VPN provider, who you send your traffic using an application on your computer or your phone, and it encrypts that traffic and sends it to the ISP, and then the ISP doesn't know what you're doing anymore. And then the VPN provider takes that traffic, goes get the website or whatever it is you're looking for, brings it back to you, re-encrypts it, and sends it to you. You decrypt it on your computer, and boom, you're private, or at least so far. And I'll explain why we did what we did next. So that's the basic idea.
But would a VPN provider then be the person or the organization be able to see what you are doing? Or?
Well, now you understand why we sold the company. So yes, that's the next step. So first, before we get that, let me just explain the reasons why people use this stuff in addition to wanting to be private. Because selling privacy, as an experience, it's not the simplest thing in the world to like tell people, hey, you should be more private, right? You know, if you use systems today and people are like, hey, don't you have two-factor authentication on your email? You're like, well, why would I need that? It's too complicated. And you're like, well, someone's going to guess your password eventually. You're like, it never gets my password. It's like, you know, my daughter's name and, you know, my birthday. It's like, oh, really? Okay, I'm going to guess that one really fast. And that example of like the inconvenience of security is the reason why we don't do these things, you know, all the time. We decide that we're willing to trade convenience for privacy or security. Other reasons why you actually use VPNs today are things like geolocation, which means I'm in Lisbon. I would like to watch HBO. Well, I'm going to go pretend I live in the United States, which I used to, but quite recently. So I can use a VPN to make it look like my traffic is coming from the United States. Now, this is technically a copyright violation because the companies have copyright agreements where they're only allowed to show HBO shows in the United States. And hopefully my HBO subscription doesn't get canceled now that I've admitted this, but people do this regularly.
Oh, yeah. I got friends in France and Germany that are trying to watch the popular Netflix shows, and they can't get them in Europe.
Yep. And the content providers and the servers now work very, very hard to try and detect if you are using it because they don't want to get screwed by the copyright issues. And there are other solutions to this in the future, which I hope we'll get to. But I think eventually a lot of this stuff will feel like AOL feels like right now, like these walled gardens will just break apart. And then some of these things might not be so, you know, necessary. Then maybe VPNs will be more about privacy and more security. There are other things like in crypto, if you want to trade on certain exchanges, you're not allowed to be from the US. Even if you are not a US citizen, let's say you're visiting from Singapore and you trade on Binance every day, which is a popular website, not accessible from US IP. So legally, you're doing that, but Binance says, hey, sorry, you're coming from the US. We can't serve US citizens. And you're like, okay, I'm going to use VPN to make sure like I look like so I'm not in the United States, right? Yeah, geofencing, geolocation is another aspect of why people do these things and why they're so popular. The phrase VPN actually means a couple of different things. The context that we're having this conversation is within the context of consumer VPN, which is people who download VPNs onto their devices.
So in other words, if I have an unprotected device connecting into the VPN, I just gave it its own secure tunnel. So VPNs aren't infallible. It also depends on what devices you have connected to them. But that's enterprise and we're talking consumer. Okay.
Infallible is an interesting statement. VPNs work as well as you design them. If you take an infected machine and connect it to a network that's not infected, you're probably going to infect that machine. So
the
VPN was actually doing the job it was intended to do.
Got it. Okay.
I guess there are dozens, if not hundreds, of companies offering VPNs. So I'm just wondering, why did you decide to start another one? Why did you start Orchid?
Well, let me explain what it is. So we're not actually a VPN company. One of the reasons we started the company was actually an observation that there are a lot of VPN companies. Like, where is the Google of VPNs? Right? Where is, who would you go trust? And, you know, there are some great VPN companies out there, and I could make a list of the ones I would recommend. But what a VPN company does normally is they provide you with a client, something you download on your phone or a computer, and then they provide the VPN service, the thing I talked about, which is a series of servers located all over the parts of the world. You connect to those servers, you pay them a monthly fee, and then you get VPN access and you are happy, right? We don't do that. What we do is we're an open source company. We have an open source client and some open source software that anybody can run to provide VPN service. And so initially when we launched the company, what we did was we partnered with what we thought was, you know, I think the number is strangely seven, but I think it's seven still, seven professionally run VPN companies who we'd audited and decided that they actually adhered to the kind of privacy principles we believe. Now, the way we designed our software, in some cases, the way if you run it in a certain way, it doesn't really matter whether they adhere to the privacy principles that we like because they still don't know anything about you. So we're not a VPN company. We're like a meta layer on top of VPN. Now, why is this interesting? As you were suggesting, the VPN business is also probably going to depend in some cases on data. And there are VPN companies, I'm not going to call them out, who also sell the data about traffic to hedge funds and retail outlets and so on. It's a business. And of course, it's aggregated. But as I think, you know, you may understand, aggregation is only as good as the smaller slice that you give it. You know, if you look for, you know, sort of people almost 2 meters tall who, you know, born in England and lived in San Francisco and now live in Lisbon and work in the crypto space, there's one person. It's me. So, you know, the slice is only as good as the anonymization you do. Aggregated data selling and hiding behind that is not happening. None of these guys are doing homomorphic encryption, for example, or like zero knowledge proofs. They're getting really technical here, but that's the future of those kind of things, most of those models. But so you have to trust your VPN. And now, given that there are hundreds, which one do you trust? Well, what you do is you go read a guide, read top VPN guide or someone else's guide. Problem with most of them, and there are some good ones, however, they're providing websites for free and they're getting paid by the VPN company. So it's really how much is the VPN company willing to bid to get itself on that ranking, right? So we thought about this a lot. The idea we came up with is a couple of things. And actually, another part of this is that when you connect to the VPN company in order to subscribe, you also have to give them your name, your address, your billing information, and so on. So now, if I'm a VPN company, I get a call, knock, 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 from some government agency or someone else, or even I'm just selling data to a hedge fund. Now, the traffic is now correlated with that information about you. So now I know that who you are, where you're going, where you came from, what you're doing, right? So that correlation becomes incredibly powerful data and valuable, of course. Now, a couple of things there. So first of all, on the payment side, we observed that, well, wouldn't it be cool if you could pay for VPNs using a different kind of payment mechanism? I think of cryptocurrency, and one thing we're looking at it is it's the currency that computers should use, right? It's like, if I've got one computer trying to pay another computer, it doesn't give it a credit card. It doesn't like sort of a bank wire transfer. Mm-hmm. It definitely doesn't use physical cash. It needs to use something that can speak computer language. Now, think about like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. It's just like currencies that are written in computer language. Literally, they are, right? So if we're talking from computer to computer, from my computer to a VPN server, then probably maybe that should just be a computer currency, right? So that's why the idea of using cryptocurrency. The other cool thing about using cryptocurrency is now that information about who you are and your credit card information and so on is not correlated with your payment. It's crypto. So we've stepped down a little bit. The second idea here is more subtle, but it will come quite obvious, which is that let's say I want to pass a message from, I want to give a care message, right? So I was like, okay, I'm going to give it to you and then you're going to give it to Kay. I'll say, well, why don't I just give it to Kay? Well, if I give it to you, you know, I can't reach Kay for some reason. So I give it to you. And you go, okay, cool. I'm going to take a look at the message. Okay, cool. I know all the messages. I'm going to give it to Kay. Now you know what I did. Mm-hmm. Well, what if you had a friend involved in this situation too, or someone that you didn't know? And what the deal was that I'm going to take this message and I'm going to encrypt it and I'm going to pay you to send it to your friend who's then going to get paid to send it to Kay. Kay's going to read it, write something down, send it back to me and get paid on the way back. And this technique is called onion routing. And there's a popular free program called Tor, which was built around this idea. is the idea that you can message pass and data pass information by including more people in this chain. We call them like, kind of like hopping bunnies. Mm-hmm. In order to make the information more private. So now,
is that why the bunnies on Orchid? Okay, we can go down that question later. Keep going.
So yeah, we have a dark version of the bunny coming out, so be ready for that one. So we had too many complaints that everything was too fluffy, so we're making it darker. So the white hats. So this idea of like having more than one VPN provider in the loop, or more than one provider and no provider in the loop of the message passing, now means that nobody in this chain of hops knows who I am and where I'm going. They might be able to figure out who I am, essentially from my IP address and so on, but they don't know where I'm going, because only the last person in the chain knows where I'm going, and they don't know who I am. So these two pieces of information are now decorrelated, which means that your privacy in the system is... Okay, why else would we use cryptocurrency? Why else do we do this? Well, our plan, like right now we have this small set of providers, and it's basically a function of like how much traffic is in the network, and also like making sure the network really works. When you're building security systems, you don't want to rush it, right? Because if you rush it and you get it wrong, like bad things happen. So we're trying to build out the network carefully and improve a lot of things. But the idea eventually is that you guys could be node providers. Somebody who knows how to run VPN services and, you know, set up and doing it. Someone could start their own little VPN company, and then maybe we can connect a lot of these other VPN companies, 100 people and so on, who are in many cases starving for traffic because, you know, markets tend to congregate up to a few winners and a lot of losers or not so successful. They could become nodes in the Orchid network. And how would they get paid? Well, you're not going to set up bank transfer information and credit card information between hundreds or thousands of potential people in the network. You need to use cryptocurrency or use other things. But this system works very well in the sense that with Orchid, any node provider can get paid in the network without having to set up a separate billing arrangement and a separate like credit card information and so on. It just gets sent and you get paid as long as you provide service. Does that explain it pretty well? Mm-hmm. Get it?
Yeah. I get it, Kate.
Yeah.
Good.
Probably not as well as the two of y'all do, but I'm sure the listeners are probably a little bit more sophisticated on technology than I am. I do love it, and you do explain it very well.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. I still want to go back to hops and bunnies, but I guess I could continue to go down the whole technology strain.
We can go into whatever meme you want to go into. I'm down.
Oh, did you have something before I go down another track?
No, go ahead. Go down to bunny trail. You like bunny trails.
I was going to go down the bunny trail, seriously. So when I went to Orchid.com and I was popping around to look and see what exactly can we put you on the spot for, I love the fact that you have bunnies everywhere on the website. I don't know if that's a characteristic of essentially a tech startup company, but the very informal, we're your friend kind of presentation. So why bunnies?
So the broader narrative here, which is...
And there's no bunnies repeated. It doesn't look like... I'm looking at all the bunnies and it doesn't look like...
Oh, the pictures of the people? Yeah. So I think what you're asking is that we have a team page, and the team page has images of bunnies or like cartoon characters, and yes, they are, none of them repeat, they're all unique, and we all chose them carefully based on an AI algorithm which actually built a bunny out of our faces. And no, just kidding, we have great artists.
Oh, you so, were about to really get my attention there on that one, because you can create, you know,
it's faces. it's a deep fake. Yeah,
but you know, if they can create people from, you can go online and create the person, I forget what the website is. Yeah. I mean, why not?
You know, the crypto art movement, the NFT space, we're going to be selling NFTs of those things too also. Yeah. So it's just a great idea. So I think we should donate the money to some privacy charity.
Right. Exactly.
Getting serious now about bunnies. So the serious thing here is our observation was that the way that people sell privacy and security is to scare you, right? Mm-hmm. There's two motivations. Well, lots of motivations as well, but let's just take fear and greed as the big ones. You take fear and you say, you should be scared. Hackers are coming after you. You're not private and so on. And in fact, a lot of the things that people say related to VPNs are sort of true, as like, does a VPN protect you from being hacked? Well, yeah, if you're connected to a really unsecure Wi-Fi network and, you know, you download the wrong piece of malware and then you maybe get hacked. But does the VPN stop that happening? VPNs don't stop you from clicking on links that you shouldn't be clicking on. There's no like warning sign coming up saying you shouldn't click on this. So they don't really, that's not really true, but they, you're motivated. You're like, I heard my friend got hacked. I'm going to go download a VPN. And so they scare you. And whenever you find the news comes out about, you know, privacy is being invaded and so on, VPN sales go through the roof. And that's a good thing because I think more people should use VPNs. But selling people with fear only goes so far. And in fact, we have almost like a security, like a sort of a, you know, like we're exhausted by hearing about how we're insecure. We're exhausted about hearing these stories about, you know, why it's, why you need to do more to protect yourself because, you know, like you're going to get, this is going to happen. We often think about the internet as this other world, especially, you know, old, those of us long in the tooth like me is like, you know, I remember the world before the internet. Remember before cell phones.
I was explaining that to a reporter today about how I had to look up lupus back before there was internet.
My PhD, and I spent a lot of time in the library, even though I was, you know, I had email address since 1989. I was like very into the internet, but it wasn't the internet as today. So, but today, you know, and I have children and they don't think, and I talk to them about this. I say, do you think of the internet as not the real world and then the real world is separate? And they're like, no, it's the same thing. It's not a distinct environment. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so the internet is really just an extension of the world we're in. And just like the world we're in is an extension of the internet. The world's a hybridized, right? So it's one world. Now, in the world we think of today, we have a lot of unnatural behaviors happening in the internet. Censorship, surveillance, the ability to like kick people off platforms, control of what you do. If we had those enforced behaviors on our natural life in the world today, we'd be protesting in the streets. And in fact, often we do. We think that the internet up until, you know, like obviously up until what we did, but, you know, up until like the kind of emergence of decentralized technologies and there's a big trend here and the kind of work that Kay, you've been doing and advocating for these things is a great example of this. There's a lot of like unnatural behavior. So we wanted to build a vision in the narrative for ORCID of it being a natural world, like kind of like an organic natural space. And that's what led to a lot of the imagery and the language we use talking about ORCID. Welcome to the natural internet was a phrase we used to use. I think we still do use it. And then our artists got to work with some of this imagery. And the next thing you know, there were these bunch of like really cute little animals emerging. And one of them was a bunny. And then we're like, hang on, don't bunnies hop? Hence bunny. So that's how we ended up in this kind of bunny.
So you did tie it to the hop thing. I like it.
Like a lot of memes, it's hard to know exactly where it started and how it emerged. But we also... back when we used to have conferences, we started doing, you know, kind of after parties for different events. And I had a very storied past. I actually ran a nightclub and an art gallery in my spare time while I was starting another company years ago. Don't do it anymore, but I still DJ here and there. And so I was like, well, you know, we should have some parties, like good DJs and so on. And the theme started becoming related to rabbits. And we had an Alice in Wonderland theme. We had a Matrix theme. If you remember the Matrix, there's a mm-hmm. part of the white rabbit on the shoulder. Yeah, it's a phrase that's unfortunately being kind of jumped on by some guys like QAnon and stuff like that right now, which was kind of scary. But I think that kind of rabbit theme and the sort of bunnies and the kind of natural concept. We're in the process of, you know, I'll give a bit of a preview here. I'm not sure when this is going to air, but in the process of starting to change a little bit of our imagery, especially in the application, to make it a little bit more sort of dark and more cypherpunk kind of vibe. But bunnies will still be there. They might be like, as we call sort of Easter eggs in the product that you have to go find. But
it still matches the theme, though.
Yeah, one of our excellent community contributors, I'll not name his name, but he knows who he is from Italy. For privacy reasons, I won't mention him, but his name. But he actually made some amazing imageries in our Telegram as like little avatars for ourselves of like different kind of bunny characters of people in the community and so on. So people love memes. Like crypto is very meme heavy and it's very... but, you know, it's an intense business to be in. So we add fun to try and make it a little bit more exciting. For
you're making me picture like punk rabbits or something. I'm Googling images of punk bunnies now.
It's not going to be Donnie Darko, that's for sure. But, you know, that did come to mind.
So let's jump back into privacy.
Is this a privacy podcast? I didn't realize.
Yeah, I was struck by one of the things you mentioned, actually. While you were explaining the bunnies, you were also talking a lot about censorship and democratization and fighting government surveillance, what we would do in real life, but that we don't always do online. And as our listeners may know, government surveillance or the fight against government surveillance is one of my favorite privacy topics.
So it is his favorite privacy topic.
So how does this, I mean, I understand how a VPN can contribute, but obviously, that situation might be different when you are in the US or somewhere in the European Union or somewhere completely outside. how would ORCID contribute, or how would your work contribute to fighting those oppressive regimes, say in Africa or right now in, for example, Myanmar?
Oh, we have started on Myanmar, you said that. Yeah, so this is the third country I've settled in. UK, I think of San Francisco as a country, also United States and now Portugal. And I think that, you know, I'm privileged to be able to count myself as a global citizen. I travel extensively to many of these regions that you talked about and firsthand experience what it feels like to go behind the firewall in China. And you're not threatening to me, but all of a sudden you're like, hang on a second. I just can't do the things I'm used to doing. Like what just happened? For many people, this is just an inconvenience. For some people, it's a threat to their very existence. If you're a reporter trying to cover things in Myanmar, you should be extremely careful about how you communicate. There are great technologies out there. I will plug the Tor project for their work. An open source contributor led project. We're not trying to displace any of the existing tools that exist. We see ourselves as, you know, complementary, hopefully additive. We don't have things like messaging platforms, for example, like, you know, people, there's a lot of confusion around messaging platforms right now, like push against WhatsApp because of the Facebook ownership stake, even some shade thrown against Signal, but those two we believe still are strong platforms. What do I think is interesting here? I think that what is interesting is that ORCID was lucky enough to be created and become successful and have its entire focus be on privacy technology. We don't have privacy technology as add-on that we use to sell something else. But, I mean, I like Apple, but when I see banner ads for Apple and billboards in Berlin with like, Apple is privacy, I'm like, well, yeah, you are, but you sell iPhone, right?
Right.
Like, you know, your product is not privacy. It's a component of the product.
Yeah, we get that given TrustArc as entirely privacy dedicated software.
So you get it. It's a different way of thinking. It's a challenging road. Right? So it's like there's many better ways to go make money, like trading GameStop, for example. But you can think about these things as kind of when we initially started it, and I was, you know, fortunate to be able to pitch to amazing investors globally and especially in Silicon Valley. And one of the questions I got asked was like, well, what's the worst case scenario? Like, well, the worst case scenario is we change the narrative. If we can just change the narrative by doing what we're doing, I consider that an important step. And we've been lucky enough to do more than change the narrative and actually create tools and technologies that not only can our users use, but people can build on. I mean, just to remind everybody, it's a completely open source system. If you wanted to take the open source software for ORCID right now, you don't have to use our token to do it. You can go build other technologies from it. It's available. It's there, ready to go. The clients that we have on Android, iPhone, all the desktop platforms, there's nothing hidden. You can just go grab it and go your own thing. Now, open source, which has been this incredibly revolutionary technology, and I almost think that we don't talk enough about open source in the world, has become this thing where you can say, I can now take what other people have done. I can stand on the shoulders of giants. Right? Most of the world's computing infrastructure is based on Linux. Like everyone thinks it's like Windows or IBM or something, but it's actually Linux. Linux is a completely open source platform. Yes, people make money from Linux. People sell services. People sell tools on top of it. But if we can get a change in the narrative and a change in the way people think and have the tools available such that as people become more and more aware that they need privacy online and the real world is the internet world and the internet world is the real world and there's no distinction, as long as we've got the tools and the technologies available for them to get at that point in time, I think we're in a better world. So that's the big pitch as to why we do what we do. I think that was a question, but I might have taken it in another direction.
No, that's absolutely wonderful. Everything you're saying is things that I think will resonate with our listeners. And the other thing that I think is we're getting close to running out of time is let's close giving a little bit of plug for your virtual summit on digital privacy. This upcoming TrustArc has one coming next week on March 10th and 11th. It looks like yours is a little almost 2 weeks after that, March 23rd, 25th. Tell us about your summit.
So this was an idea we had last year. Actually, I had a marketing, Amanda had this vision and this name. And I was like, wow, I think we should just even just do something based on the name alone. That's an incredible name. Prive with an A, P-R-I-V-A. So just to plug the website, it's orcid.com/private, which is P-R-I-V-8. So it's a take on private. There's an interesting one. So There's also a connection there with Facebook has a conference called F8. Or like, well, I do not want my fate to be Facebook. I want my fate to be private. So
I want private. I like it.
Yeah. Sounds great.
And so unlike a lot of sort of company driven conferences, we're not going to be standing up here trying to pitch all of our products and so on. I leave that for the podcast, like you guys. Thank you so much.
And we usually don't pitch products, but I wanted to because of your summit.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Hopefully I've been able to add some more of that to the conversation. But we wanted to bring industry leaders, advocates, experts, you know, people that aren't always in the same place, just to talk about digital privacy. It's this incredibly important subject that's got so much attention over the last few years, and people realize more and more, and the stuff you guys are doing now to do that. And so we started organizing this thing, and initially we were thinking we'd do one in person, and now it turns out we're doing one virtually, which we've all got much better at. So I had to learn that skill. It's like I got good at standing up on stage and doing my sermon thing, and then I had to suddenly like sit on my own with my cats as audiences here.
I will tell you the most unusual standing up on stage was a round stage in Las Vegas talking privacy to salespeople.
Oh, wow.
That was not the most comfortable experience ever, but okay.
Yeah, we have this conference coming up. It's March 23rd to 25th. It's free to register. Just go to the website. It's going to be, you know, a streaming. And we're very excited to have some incredible speakers. You may have heard of a gentleman called Edward Snowden. Yeah. Interestingly, at a lot of the conferences I've been to, I've actually been fortunate to see him speak a number of times, I think 3 or 4 times now. He appears virtually, right? So because he is not able to leave where he is right now, unfortunately. Let's not get into that. But so probably guess where I stand on that one. But the cool thing now is that instead of Snowden having to come to us, we're coming to him. We're meeting him in the virtual world. So he's going to be there. And there's a lot of amazing extra speakers there. Audrey Tang, Sheila Warren, Zuko Wilcox out of Zcash, Cindy Cohn from ES, some guy called Seven, Ryan Selkis from Masari, Brian Bellendorf, who's like super early in open source and Linux Foundation. Yeah, there's like some amazing names. I highly recommend it. Even if you have, you know, half a day or a day to spend some time with us, I think you'll get a lot out of it. Yeah.
It sounds fascinating. And I've heard Snowden speak before. He always has great stories to tell and great warnings to offer, but also great advice to offer. So I'm really looking forward to that.
I think the advantage I find with having the chance to talk to people like this and listen to them is that we're often all very, very focused on the near term and so on. But people like this, they're looking further, and they're providing, like, you know, indicators and warnings and signals that as we're building the things we're building, as we're doing the things that you guys are doing and talking about it, are incredibly valuable to us to say, well, you know, what should I be thinking about next? And how should I be concerned about this? And that's powerful. Like, step away, see the woods, you know, the forest from the tree.
On that message, I'm going to thank you very much for being our guest today, and thank our listeners for listening to yet another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and rate and review our episodes in your favorite podcast app. Should you have any questions or suggestions, or if you would like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustart.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as EuroPolB. For now, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMSI Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.